Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. All right. I was far from 100% at booking guests this week, but that means you get to have more fun and more airtime as we open up the phones again until 9:30. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. At 9:30, we're going to hear about what's going on at the Bennington Museum. They're getting ready for a big outdoor sculpture show that's opening tomorrow. Also tomorrow, Burlington has a full day of Juneteenth festivities that we're going to learn about at 10:30. In between, national correspondent Bob Ney is back. After he was traveling last Friday, he'll be with us. And then Ann Wallace Allen of 7 Days will tell us about the turtle savior. So that's what we have coming up for the rest of the show right now. Let's start the conversation with you. You get us started here. Let's see. I do have a couple events to talk about this morning. So if you want to share something that you're attending or places that you like to recommend to other listeners, let us know. 244-1777. 877-291-8255. We talked about those dreaded gypsy moths earlier in the week. If you've been seeing their handiwork, let us know. You can call in. And, I have a couple of homework assignments to report back on, including closed highway rest areas and unsolicited seed packets. And I'll see if I can do better than the incomplete grade that I got yesterday. Yes, I got an I on both of those. Not even like a, I couldn't even get a passing C. And I did socialize again. Wednesday night I was out, and I'll let you know if I was any better re-engaging than my first attempt, which was last Saturday. I think I was a little bit boorish on Saturday. But, you know, we're all learning how to get back into society and socialize and things like that. All right. Open phones. Our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com is the email address. And, of course, we can talk about whatever subject you'd like. You can get us started. And so one of the subjects that came up, Ray, got this going a couple days ago, and he wanted to know, a few years back, we had interstate rest areas close, and what's the deal? Why were they closed? Why don't we commercialize them? What happened? And he couldn't remember exactly when. Several people suggested that that happened during the Governor Dean administration. I have not found that. I've been digging to see if there were any that did close when Howard Dean was governor. It could well have been. He was governor for a long stretch, but it could just be that I'm just not finding that search. Now, I did mention that there were four on the chopping block, and I think this was Lee Cattell's handiwork. Found an updated story from February of 2009. I had something from December of 2008. And they did close permanently, it says, at least three highway rest areas, cut hours at other facilities as it continues to trim the state budget. And if you remember, that was the Great Recession, and the state was really looking, we were $60 million short of having an even budget, a balanced budget. And so we were looking for a lot of reasons, a lot of things we could do as a state. So they closed rest areas on I-91 in Hartford, I-89 in Sharon and Highgate, and I-89 northbound facility in Randolph shut down by the end of the month. So I guess they did do four. Officials say the Randolph rest area will be closed permanently. Lawmakers also leaning toward reducing hours at the 17 remaining spots starting in July of that year, which they did. Vermont Buildings Commissioner Jerry Myers said the state has more pressing human services programs that needed funding. And the plan, so originally I said it was going to save $1 million a year. This was updated to say the plan was expected to save the state about $1.4 million annually. So that was during Jim Douglas, his reign as governor in 2009. And it was tight times, if you remember. They were really trying to find, you know, where you could nibble around the edges that you wouldn't notice too much. But you did when you were on the highway. So Ray called back in yesterday and said, well, what I really wanted to know was not just, you know, that they were closed, but why don't we commercialize them, right? Why don't we have somebody run them, and that way, you know, the state not only saves money, but they're open all the time. We see it elsewhere, and I thought it was a good suggestion. And Bill picked this up, I think, and pointed out this. Bill said in an email, it's my understanding that commercial uses are prohibited within interstate highway corridors by federal law. And Bill is my new research assistant. I appreciate Bill. He found this from the USDOT website. It says, can I set up a business in safety rest areas or welcome centers selling food and other products to motorists? And the answer was no. And I'll try not to bore you too much with it, but very interesting stuff. Section 111 of the Title 23 United States Code prohibits the states from commercializing the right-of-way along the interstate system. The commercial prohibition in Section 111 dates to 1956, when Congress was considering the legislation that launched the Interstate Highway Program. The members considered following the model of the toll turnpikes that provided commercial facilities and service areas for motorists who would otherwise have to leave the facility and pay a toll to continue their journey. Congress rejected this model by enacting the Section 111 prohibition on commercialization. The Surface Transportation Assistance Act of 1982 modified the commercial restriction by permitting vending machines in rest and recreation areas constructed or located on the interstate right-of-way. So I did mention that some of these rest areas did have vending machines yesterday. That was allowed as of 1982. Very interesting. Bill's email also goes on to say safety rest areas are intended to serve motorists by allowing them to take a short break, use the restrooms, shake off drowsiness, and then move on. The absence of commercial services, except for those vending machines, means motorists can stop without any pressure to make purchases. For food, gasoline, lodging, and other commercial services, motorists can leave the highway and return to it without a toll charge. And I guess the other rationale would be that you don't want to, you know, kind of take away from possible sales for those businesses in the area, right? So Vermont businesses do, you know, reap some rewards for having no real commercialization on the interstates. Now, as I read this, the one thing I thought about was, well, I know in New York State, there's the New York State Thruway, I-87, and before you get on it down in Sloatsburg, or if you're going south after you get off it, there are these types of rest areas commercialized, and they are before you actually are paying a toll. Bill, he's the best research assistant I've ever had. Bill says, and he kind of read my mind, there are some interstates that are grandfathered, such as the New York Thruway, and allowed to have commercial operations because the interstate highway was built on a pre-existing state highway corridor. Well done, Bill. So there you go, Ray. Unfortunately, your master plan, which was a good one, I was ready to sign off on it. I was ready to make you governor. We can't do it on the interstates. So the only other option would be to reopen some of those rest areas, have the vending machines. Now, I had pointed out that at exit 7, there's now the Maplewood. I was, again, I got that wrong, too. It's the Maplewood Travel Service Center, and that is open 24 hours, has great facilities. But Jim in Waterbury called me to task. He emailed, and well, he should. He said, I just have a couple comments regarding the discussion yesterday morning about closure of the interstate rest areas. I was working at the time, so I couldn't call in. First, I may live in Waterbury now, but I grew up in Berlin. On behalf of your Berlin listeners, I have to tell you that we take offense when people identify everything at the top of the hill as either Barrie or Montpelier. That's like saying WDEV is based in Moortown or Duxbury. Exit 6 and 7 may serve Barrie, but they are both fully in Berlin. Check a map, and he is so right. So are the hospital, airport, the Berlin Mall, Berlin Pond, which I love, as well as those car dealerships, the 802 Cars group. Don't leave out Riverton or Montpelier Junction or much of the Barrie-Montpelier Road, including the Wayside. My mom used to say, I love this, Jim, great quote. My mom used to say that Berlin is what kept Barrie and Montpelier from going to war. Great thing. Now, his second point is, regarding the rest areas, while the budget was one reason they were closed, many of their septic systems were way beyond their expected lifetimes, and upgrades would have cost a fortune. The Welcome Center on I-91 was moved several miles north so it could tie into the Brattleboro sewer system. The new one in Sharon is already over capacity. Check out the signs over the toilets warning people that the water in them is not potable. And he says, where are you supposed to fill your canteens then? Great email from Jim. He did take me to task. It's not a Barrie exit. It is in Berlin, and I apologize for that. And so is the Welcome Center. All right. So there is all that I got wrong about the rest areas, and we are going to talk to the Duke of Newbury. Here's Fred. Hey, Fred, how you doing?
Morning.
That's
a pretty good one, Duke. It sticks.
That's right.
Hey, this is interesting. I don't know if it's interesting or not, but I think it is because you hear about it a lot, and that is critical race theory. So I looked up critical race theory, and I discovered that by reading the definition of critical race theory, it's like being a person that's not very good at arithmetic reading the definition of the theory of large numbers. So it boils down to one thing. Critical race theory perhaps just means racism. I don't know. It's very confusing. How would you explain it?
Well, I'm not sure I can. What is the definition that you're referring to?
What, critical race theory?
Yeah,
I looked it up. What's the definition of critical race? I looked it up. And the definition is so complicated, you've got to be a sociologist to understand it. Just like the numbers of high, the theory of large numbers, you've got to be a mathematician to understand it.
All right.
So do you know what critical race theory is?
Can't say I do. Why is this something that's on your mind, Fred?
Because everybody's talking about it. I mean, is critical race theory actually going to solve a problem when nobody knows really what it is? That's the point.
Well, I'll read the Wikipedia definition, and you know, your point is spot on. It's an academic movement of civil rights scholars and activists who seek to critically examine the law as it intersects with issues of race and to challenge mainstream liberal approaches to racial justice. But just because I can't quite, you know, in sitting down here and reading it, can't give you a definition of it. Doesn't make it right or wrong. I'm not sure exactly what it is, and I'd love to hear, you know, someone who could explain it practically, you know, what it does mean in everyday use. But when you read the definition that I just did, yeah, it is confusing, and certainly does leave you wondering, you know, what it is and you know how it is, Fred. You know, we need a clearer explanation, and we need someone to explain it, you know, who can. It's not you or I think, obviously.
I think you're very honest about it. That was very, very, I mean, I feel better. I don't feel like the Lone Ranger.
Yeah. We're in this together, you know, and we definitely need someone to interpret it for us. And we'll leave that out there, because maybe another caller can.
That'd be nice. I would like that.
This is definitely not my wheelhouse, so I'm not even going to pretend to try to answer that one.
I think crowdsourcing might be the answer.
That's the way it's done. That's what we've done with these questions about the rest areas here in Vermont. So, all right, Fred Duke, keep things going there in Newbury.
Okay.
Give my best to the Duchy.
I will.
All right. All right, that's Fred in Newbury. You can join us, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can toss one my way that I don't know the answer to. That seems to be the real strength of open phones right now. Now, we also heard the other day from Beth, and she wanted to know about those seed packets that were sent out from China. People were getting them. They were unsolicited. They didn't know what to do. They didn't know what they were. And she wanted to know, why they were sent, what was in them. Well, it turned out that they were pretty much harmless. They were things that you would find, that you would plant in your garden. And it was done in an attempt, it was something called brushing, where a company will send you something unsolicited, and now they have your information, and they will post reviews, very positive ones, about their product. So those seed products, I guess, got great reviews from those of you who received them. The one thing I was not able to explain was, what do you do with the seed packets? Now, this is a year later, but I'm sure people have held on to them, didn't know. And so I did go back and double-check this. And they said that anyone who receives an unsolicited package of seeds from China should immediately contact their state plant regulatory official or HIS State Plant Health Director, and that's the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, APHIS. Maybe they call it APHIS. I don't know, but Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service. They say, please hold on to the seeds and packaging, including the mailing label, until someone from your State Department of Agriculture or APHIS can contact you with further instructions. So if you have those hanging around and you never got in touch with the Ag Department, give them a call, let them know. By now they might just tell you to toss them, but I don't think they want you to definitely not plant them, and you probably should get them back to the state or the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, which is a new thing for me. I didn't know that was a service, but they're doing it. All right, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Your chance here with open phones to pop in, ask me a question, embarrass me, whatever you like. Let's see. Uh-oh. Now Linda emailed and says, Art in Moortown. It's half right that the Wayside is in Berlin. The diner is divided in half by the town city line of Berlin and Montpelier. Oh, thank you, Art. So the previous email that I got from Jim in Waterbury, because I misidentified Berlin and called it Barry, and I apologize for that. Art says, the Wayside is in Berlin and Montpelier. It's divided. And I wonder who they pay their taxes to. It reminds me of 40th and Allen. And so that was, a fort for the U.S. Army from the 1890s through about 1960. And it is bisected. And half of it is in Colchester and half in Essex. And so there's, a bit of a conundrum there. As a matter of fact, the green out front is dissected like that as well. And the Colchester Rec Department actually has jurisdiction over it, even though part of it is Essex, part of it is Colchester. So thanks to Art in Moortown for that clarification on the Wayside Diner. I wonder if you go in and you can say, I'd like to sit on the Berlin side this morning. Your choice. All right. One more thing that I mentioned. Get a sneaker in here if you call now, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. But reacclimatizing to the social scene, I did go out on Wednesday night, met some friends, and went to the St. John's Club in Burlington. And I think I was much better behaved this time than my – I was at a party on Saturday, and I was a bit boorish. I was, loud, and you can tell I was like a bottled-up genie who was just released. I just could not stop talking and trying to make people laugh and, be in the center of attention. At least on Wednesday, I was a little more subdued. Maybe it was the surroundings. Who knows? But I think I did better on attempt number two to reintegrate with life as we knew it and hopefully know it again now that we're over 80% vaxxed here in Vermont. So I think I'm getting better. I'll keep updating you as I progress or regress. We'll see. I'll try to behave. All right. Looks like that's going to do it for this version of Open Phones, commonly known now as Expose the Things Rick Knows Nothing About. We're going to take a break, and when we return, we're going to check out the southwest corner of the state, see what's happening at the Bennington Museum, a really interesting place. And we've got Red Sox baseball again tonight. They had the night off yesterday. They head to Kansas City, open a three-game series against the slumping Royals. Coverage begins tonight at 7:10, first pitch, 8:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. I love taking you around the state to introduce you to the many fabulous places you and your family can check out as you tour the state and get to know it better. Today, we're heading down to Bennington, and we're going to spend the next half hour learning about the amazing exhibits on offer at the Bennington Museum. Here to serve as our guide this morning is David Piliczowski, interim director of the museum. David, great to have you on the program.
Good morning, Rick. Great to be here with you and your listeners.
Thanks. Listeners, to ask David a question about the museum, or if you want to share a visit to the museum, tell us about when you've been there, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Our email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. David, when you first introduce people to the Bennington Museum, what do you want them to know about it?
Well, most are curious about the strengths of the collection. So I would share that our collection of Grandma Moses is the largest anywhere in the world. That we have a deep historic collection involving Revolutionary War, and in particular the Battle of Bennington, fought in August 16th, 1777. Quilt lovers and quilters know us through the Jane Stickle quilt, which was produced in 1863. And that quilt, believe it or not, has worldwide following. That was a surprise to me, but I really appreciate the quilt.
Yep.
And then, and that is on display from Labor Day through Indigenous Peoples Day. And then also Bennington-based pottery. Both Norton and United States Pottery Company are well represented here, and those are the highlights. But there's really a lot more going on here. Like other museums and cultural organizations, we had our challenges with lockdown and slow recovery. Mm-hmm. So it forced us to develop virtual or online programs, and we've done that, and that's something we're actually continuing to do. So even if you can't make it to Bennington, our programs are available through our website. BenningtonMuseum.org is the way to reach us.
Yeah, David, because of Grandma Moses, I've always thought of the Bennington Museum as an art museum, but as you mentioned, that's only really part of what you're doing there.
That's correct, Rick. Art is, we really have three focuses. Art, as you mentioned, and that includes some very contemporary art, what we call Bennington Modernism, that has sprung up from Bennington College and the great creative people there. But art more broadly, history certainly, and that's something that we're broadening our focus. It's been during those years when Europeans, starting with European arrival here, and we've got an interest in expanding that to those 10,000 years before, when there really was a lot of activity throughout the state with indigenous people. For us, it's the Abenaki and the Mohicans. The third area of interest for us is nature, which in Vermont makes a lot of sense. And then when you learn that our museum has a 10-acre campus that includes the George Aiken Wildflower Trail and our participation in the North Bennington Outdoor Sculpture Show, where our curator, Jamie Franklin, is this morning installing the final two of 29 outdoor sculptures, nature is kind of a logical area for us to be involved in as well.
All right, and we're going to get deeper into all of the things you've mentioned, the exhibits, and we'll kind of take them one at a time now. So first, I'd love to talk about Grandma Moses. Tell us about her ties to Bennington and what visitors will see at the museum.
Well, we have a gallery devoted to her work, and a video interview of her taken back in, I don't know, probably the early 50s or the late 40s. She did her work in nearby Eagle Bridge, New York. We're proud to claim her, and Eagle Bridge is proud to claim her as well. Her work is so well known that we have on loan several pieces on tour in Japan. So she is certainly the highlight of the collection in terms of a focus and kind of a headliner, if you will.
Uh-huh. All right. And how many pieces of hers are on display at the Bennington Museum?
Well, I don't have a count. I would say several dozen. Maybe a bit more than that, in fact. And then not only are her art on display, Rick, we have glimpses and in display cases of the materials that she used, the paints, the brushes, and other things. The chair that she sat in, her work table is on exhibit in Japan. So normally that would be there as well. So there are artifacts associated with her work here. There are images of, Life or Time magazine cover photo of her as well. So she's pretty prominent, but not the only exciting thing here in the museum. Our museum is actually balanced between what we call the permanent galleries and then the rotating galleries. And we've got, right now we have six new exhibits in place that when we reopened in April, this past April 2021, that we put on display. I'd be glad to talk about those for a minute if you'd like.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, one of them is devoted to another important Vermont icon, Robert Frost, who's buried not far from the museum. So tell us about that exhibit.
Be glad to, yes. Robert Frost is buried in the Center Cemetery, which is just to the west of the museum. In fact, there's a path where you could easily walk from the museum to the Frost Cemetery. And then further west is the Old First Church, the Congregational Church, that was built in and opened in 1806. But the Frost exhibit, curated by Jamie Franklin, is Robert Frost at present in Vermont. As a poet, you would expect the exhibits to have to be really text-centric. A lot of primary sources. We borrowed heavily from other museums and colleges, including certainly Middlebury College. So we have examples of his works. We have, because the labels for the exhibit are so extensive. So we've got words that you're looking at. You're looking at the original manuscripts in many cases, and then there's an explanatory label next to that. It's so word heavy that we have made arrangements to record the labels, and with a QR code and your phone and hopefully Bluetooth connection, you're able to hear the labels read as you look at the primary sources. Now, what makes this exhibit interesting, and again, one of our focuses is art, is the display of numerous important works that from various. There's Rockwell Kent. There are Birchfield oils and Luigi Lucioni actual paintings. Paintings and some drawings, as well as a quilt, something called the signature quilt, which includes Robert Frost. Each one of the squares has the name of someone prominent in Vermont history and Vermont culture, particularly in the 1930s and 40s. Including Frost. So this exhibit, I've had people tell me that they need to make one or two visits to the museum just to take in the Frost exhibit. It's so extensive.
Wow, that's exciting.
And it's really an amazing exhibit. And again, that's the largest of the exhibits that's on display now. But we have several others that I'm glad to mention if you'd like.
Yeah, well, We Are Still Here is one I'd love you to talk about.
Yes, that's a key one, and it's thanks to the generosity of the Vermont Abenaki Artists Association, we're able to display artifacts, examples of clothing, of daily life from the Abenaki and that earlier period of our history, of the history of this land. The We Are Still Here is a theme that we've heard as we've developed a land acknowledgement statement in conjunction with both the Abenaki and the Mohican Stockwell Muncie Band. It's about history, but it's also about not forgetting that these people are still here with us today. In the case of the Abenaki Artists Association in Twanton, Vermont, they're very much present. The Mohican are in Wisconsin and probably some other Midwestern states as well, upper Midwestern states. They're concerned that they're geographically separate from their original tribal lands, and it's important to them that the rest of us understand that they are still with us.
David, another of the ongoing exhibits is the Bennington Modernism that you mentioned earlier. This is a really great look at something important that happened right here in Vermont.
It is. It's really a privilege to be able to highlight this collection, both in multiple media. There's some wonderful sculpture paintings that really were that broke the mold, if you will, that provide different perspective on what painting, what drawing can be, the fact that the faculty and the graduates of Bennington College have produced this work is pretty remarkable right here in our little neighborhood.
What was the time period, David, that these came out of?
I believe it was the 50s and 60s, a good deal of it, although it's still being produced well into the 70s, and some of the work continues today, and also it's right up to the present time.
Wow. Now, tomorrow, pretty big day at the museum. Tell us about NBOSS.
Yes, NBOSS is one of several things on our calendar. The North Bennington Outdoor Sculpture Show is a we co-host with the folks, and Joe Ciccarello has been the curator of that for the past 9 years. And in fact, the NBOSS is in its 24th season. Mm. This year, 2021, is the second year that we have collaborated and co-hosted sculpture, the outdoor sculpture. This past summer was so difficult, as everyone knows,
sure.
In terms of needing to be outside, wanting to be outside, finding reasons to be outside. And NBOSS gave us that opportunity last year. It was so popular that we are very pleased to continue this partnership with Joe and the folks involved, all the artists. There are artists from Stowe. It's not just this area of Vermont or contiguous New York and Massachusetts. There are three sculptors from the Montpelier area. There is someone from Stowe. There are people from Chittenden County, including Burlington. So it's really, I believe it's been characterized as the largest outdoor sculpture show in southern Vermont. And it's certainly got the history to go along with that. There's an opening session. Some of your listeners might be interested. There's an opening reception, I should say, tomorrow afternoon in North Bennington at the Vermont Art Exchange from 4 in the afternoon to 8 o'clock. There will be live music and hot dogs and cold drinks. We encourage people to join us there. That's only one of the activities that we're featuring. We developed, again last summer and continuing this summer, a program of live free concerts Friday evenings from 5 to 7. Patrick Sargent, a singer-songwriter is singing tonight, and next Friday, for example, we're going to have a Calypso band, and again, this is a free offering to the community. We had 75 people out in our courtyard and on the lawn last Friday evening, and we're just keeping our fingers crossed that every Friday evening has weather as good as it's been so far today.
Nice. And what time do those concerts in the courtyard get started each Friday?
5 p.m. So they usually run from 5 to 7. The museum is also open at that time, so you'll be able to come in and take advantage of the exhibits that are here indoors, the Frost, the Modern, Ben Modern, Bennington Modern, and as well as the We Are Still Here, among others.
David, what are the days and hours of the museum right now? And I think they expand as the summer goes on.
No, you're absolutely right, Rick. We've been open, and right now we're open Friday through Monday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. We extend now that we're starting the music, the concerts in the courtyard. We're open Friday evening until 7 p.m. Beginning July 1st and running through the end of October, we'll expand to a six-day schedule, the same hours, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., but we'll be closed only one day during the week in that period, and that would be on Wednesday. So Thursday through Tuesday, we will be open 10 to 4.
And you mentioned this before. I really want you to give us a little more information about the annual display of the quilt, the Jane Stickle quilt from 1863. You know, why is this such a big deal? You said even you were surprised to learn about it.
Well, it's so compelling. It's very, very complicated. I can't remember how many hundred pieces there are. very small scale, very detailed work. It's something that there are books written about this quilt. Mm-hmm. There are websites about it. And as I say, we did one of the virtual programs we did this past year was a conversation about the quilt. And we had people on from, various states in the U.S. We had someone on from Australia, someone on from Japan. So it's really got this very broad following. I think it was, this was created by by Jane Stickle in Shaftesbury, just north of Bennington, mm-hmm. probably at her home, using bits of cloth. There is, and I'm not an expert on the quilt. We need Callie Rasmussen, our collection manager, to fill you in. But I think that the diversity of fabric, it wasn't like the person took 10 bedspreads or 10, pieces of fabric.
Right.
Just the sources and the colors, the plethora of colors and the geometry that was involved. It's just, it's an absolute wonder. Because of the sensitivity to fabric, as you well know, to light, we're not able to put it on display for long periods of time. So that's the reason that it goes on display from Labor Day to Indigenous Peoples Day in October.
So that'll be September 3rd through October 11th of this year. And maybe we can have Carrie on during that time to learn all about that quilt. It is, again, one of those special things that the Bennington Museum has on offer. We've got about a minute left, David. Any other exhibits that we've missed that you want to make sure people know about?
Well, we do a lot of educational programs. And for example, it's called a program called Museum ABCs, and it happens that tomorrow we will be in the morning. There will be a baby goat that will be part of the festivities. I would also say that one of our other signature programs, there are two things, Rick. Love, Marriage, and Divorce is an outstanding look at that institution, the institution of marriage, and how it's changed over the years. It's historic, right up to the present time with civil unions and same-sex marriages. And again, Callie Rasmussen curated that. And I guess I should also mention the Music at the Museum program, in which primarily classical music, but variety of music, regionally notable musicians, both individually and groups, are grace us with performances four times a year. Alan Swan, who is Alan.
David, I think what we're going to have to do is we're going to guide everyone to the website, BenningtonMuseum.org. You can find all this information there. There's so much going on at the Bennington Museum. David Pilichowski is the interim director of the Bennington Museum. David, I want to thank you so much for stopping by this morning.
Rick, thanks so much for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're most welcome. We're going to head out for a few minutes, get a CBS News update. After that, after the news, we'll hear from national correspondent Bob Ney. And a reminder today, the getaway 2-4, Greg Hooker will be here. Yep, he'll be handing out the McKenzie Ultimate Grilling Package. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. National correspondent Bob Ney joins us now with an update and insights into what's happening in the world. Bob, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, thank you, Rick.
It's nice to get a double dip of Bob Ney this week. So we had Bob on Tuesday as well. Hey, Bob, let's start with the COVID numbers.
Right. Total deaths worldwide are 3,836,000. 92. We have much more stability in the United States when it comes to the figures. The total deaths were 600,880, which, you know, one death's too many, but that rate is dropping. Just to put it in perspective, Rick, new daily COVID cases rose by 1.3% in the past week. Now, that's for a wide variety of reasons. Some of that's confined to certain states, you know, where the rises occurred. Now, also, though, on the other side of it, since you and I talked, well, just a couple days ago, right, new daily death rates have fallen by 21.8%. COVID-related hospitalizations falling by 10.6%. Those are obviously much better numbers than a month or so ago.
Absolutely. Yeah, there is some very positive news here in this, in the U.S., including states that are climbing as far as percentage of people being vaccinated. So let's look at the positive side to that.
Well, what do you think the number one state in America is?
Well, I got to hope it's Vermont. I know we're skying over 80% now.
That was a rhetorical question, right? You've got them, everybody beat. So it's 80% in your state. And then in 15 states, it's at least 70% of the adults have had one dose of the vaccine of whatever type. And on the other side of it, fewer than 50% of the adults have gotten one shot in Wyoming, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. The rest of the states, 29, have reached 60% or more. So obviously Wyoming, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama have some work to do.
They do indeed. How concerned are people about the Delta variant?
Well, you know, there's a concern. Originally, when the reports of the variants were coming out, and especially the, you know, ones that were tracked in India and Africa, mm-hmm. and then eventually ended up here, there were alarm buttons. And now it seems that there's a feeling that, you know, if the vaccinations have taken hold, if you've had two vaccines, unless you're getting the Johnson & Johnson one vaccine, then they're not as alarmed as they were when the reports first came out. Although the United States is now, and it's announced yesterday, it's going to spend $3 billion to create antiviral pills. So the Biden administration is going to invest about $3.2 billion, try to develop antiviral pills, and that's to help against COVID-19. It would be, you know, a preventative measure.
And, Bob, yeah, let's talk a little bit more about this. This is something that's really developing, and I'm not sure we fully understand that. Would that be in place of a vaccine? Is this something to boost the vaccine? What are antiviral pills?
Well, what they're doing is they're trying, now this is what their idea is.
Okay.
I don't know if it'll be successful, Rick, but the program will support research on entirely new drugs that could help to respond to future pandemics that could come down, you know, down the pike. Now, also, it might help with HIV and hepatitis C, you know, because in the past we've had federally funded projects that have gone a long way, you know, with those two issues. So, you know, who knows what else this will help, you know, along. But the bottom line is they want to try to find existing antivirals. We know about remdesivir, which we've heard about a lot, mm-hmm. that had severe COVID-19, but they didn't really produce a lot of benefits. So they're trying to find something, I think, Rick, to answer your question, that will be, you know, if a new pandemic begins, these pills may be effective in reducing the, you know, some of the problems that would be out there of spreading it.
Certainly want to get ahead of any other pandemic that might, Now, very interesting, as we stay on the COVID beat right now, a deal for vaccinations between Israel and Palestine.
Yes, you know, Israel, like almost anything it does, I've always admired its ability to do all kinds of things quickly, and Israel does do that. So basically, Israel has achieved their vaccination, you know, desires and their goals. So now they're going to transfer 1.2 million doses of the Pfizer COVID vaccine to the Palestinian Authority. And then when the Pfizer vaccine is coming, which would be in October, it would go to the Israelis because they've already given the 1.2 million doses to the Palestinian Authority. This is really good news because the Palestinians were way behind on that. I mean, they were going to wait till October on it, and that just wasn't good for anybody. So I think it's good to see that, especially what's going on now, with Israel and the Palestinians, it's good to see that at least they've, for humanitarian purposes, have cut this deal, and the Palestinians can try to get ahead of the curve. They've been behind, like Iran and India and Africa, and of course, the United Kingdom is not doing that well.
And this is the brand new government that is making this offer, and the idea being that having a close neighbor like that vaccinated benefits you as well. Is that the general thinking?
Right. It's the Naftali Bennett government. He's the prime minister for the time being. I'll say that because you never know over there these days who's going to be prime minister. But, yes, it's a move afoot at least to have some type of communication between the new government and the Palestinians, at least on an issue that, you know, the Palestinians will care deeply about.
Yeah. Bob, we're a couple days past the Biden-Putin talks. So what's your takeaway now that you can look back a couple days from what we've been able to ascertain?
I think the whole trip on the summit, of course, it ended with the meeting with the two, but I think the whole trip itself went quite well. And friends of mine, of course, on the Republican side said, well, Bob, the media treated him with kid gloves. Well, they didn't treat the vice president with kid gloves. She made some statements and got into some problems on her trip. And the president basically, I think we have to be frank about it, avoided faux pas. He went over, you know, he talked with world leaders. It's not one of those conferences where you walk away and say, wow, you know, they really cut some deals. They got along. That's where that concluded, and I think that was okay. When it comes to Putin, Biden, the president was pretty smart, and his advisors, to dumb this down, as I call it, which they took expectations and took them way down. They didn't put the bar high. We're going to come out of this. It's going to be amazing. They came out with a couple of things that they could agree on. Putin, I think, was the big key to this. Maybe he wants to be seen in a different light around the world. So I don't think there was any extreme damage done. We didn't give away anything. Nobody gave away their soul, you know, because everybody talks about Putin and his soul. So I think it was better that it occurred than it didn't. But there's nothing that you can look at and say, wow, you know, they really concluded the deal. But it came out, I think, okay for the Biden administration. I really do.
Russia, just one of the hot spots for the Biden administration. The other is China. Talks there?
Well, you know, this was a big deal because, very interesting, the Biden administration came out and said, hey, you know, we met with Putin, so we may meet now and set up a meeting with the president of China, Xi, and they're going to do that, of course, with them, with China. We have a whole variety of issues on the table. That could be a pretty contentious meeting. It might actually be more contentious than the meeting with Putin, because there are just so many issues with China. But I expect that in the probably not to be held here, I wouldn't think, but maybe in some neutral country.
Yeah. All right. We'll keep watching that. Let's stay in Asia and North Korea. Sounds like things there are worse than Kim Jong-un has been leading on.
Right. On this one, Kim Jong-un has finally admitted basically that his people are starving. I mean, he really, it was shocking. But as far as the rest of it, it's just, I hate to even report on this story because, you know, it's the same old thing, the same old, same old. Kim Jong-un said his country should prepare for dialogue with the United States and especially confrontation with the United States. It's like nothing changes with that guy at all. But again, a bright spot is that he finally admits that they have such a food shortage, so maybe he will take the hermit kingdom and open it up a little bit to at least get his people some food.
When you were in Congress, did you ever have any dealings with his father?
No. The only thing I did was President Clinton had wanted to do a deal, and the White House called me and some others, and I went along with it. I supported it. It was to give $2 billion. And, you know, the president, and I don't criticize Clinton for this. At the time, they said, look, if basically privately said, you know, if you can take this crazy guy and calm him down and the world down, it's $2 billion. I thought it was a good idea. It never came to fruition. Each president has tried to do different things. I think President Trump was right on the edge. You know, he got so far and did some bold things, but then again, that fell apart. But I never had dealings directly with the government of Korea, but we did with the White House to try, you know, what I you know, give Clinton credit for trying, you know, why not try to calm the whole situation down, hopefully with money, but it just didn't work.
I think Dennis Rodman has done the best as far as diplomacy with North Korea.
Well, that's true.
Right?
Basketball diplomacy,
yeah,
exactly.
All right, and let's bring it back to the states. Domestic issue, the Supreme Court on an Affordable Care Act ruling. What happened there?
Now, this one is a big, big deal. Now, people will say, well, wait a minute. The Supreme Court didn't rule on the issue. They ruled on the case being brought. Did they have standing, the people bringing the case? Well, that's true. And the Supreme Court ruled there was no standing. There was no damage to the parties involved. But here's the point, though. Third time's the charm. This is third time it's being dismissed. And I'll tell you what shocked me, Rick, 7-2.
Right.
It wasn't just a, you know, and this is the conservative Supreme Court that, you know, the House was talking about putting more people on the Supreme Court. They may not have to. So on this issue, they did. And I really think the court probably, frankly, did the Republicans a favor, because if this had went down, what would you do? You know, 30-some million people. Now, that's not to say that the Affordable Care Act doesn't have some problems. It certainly does that need corrected. But on this one, I would say this is it. I think a lot of Republican leaders like Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell are going to kind of not be able to campaign on this anymore and not be able to do anything about it except fix the bad parts of the bill.
Mm-hmm. And when you say 30 million people, that's the 30 million people who would be without health insurance if the Affordable Care Act went away. Is that what you're saying?
Down. Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. All right. A few weeks ago, we learned about what kinds of turtles Vermont is home to. Now it's time for more turtle talk, but this of a different kind, as we learn the story of Steve Perrin of Moncton. Ann Wallace Allen is here to fill us in. Ann, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks so much, Rick. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. First of all, who is Steve Perrin?
So Steve Perrin is a biologist who started working for the State Department of Fish and Wildlife in the early 1990s. And he evolved very quickly into a job where he ran the Non-Game and Natural Heritage Program, which was set up to aid all of the animals and other things in Vermont that are not game, are not shot or hunted, like fish or whatever, fish and deer and moose and things like that. So many, many decades ago, there were actually bounties on animals that were considered to be bad for business or bad for agriculture. And, you know, Vermonters were encouraged to shoot them.
Mm-hmm.
And by the 1980s, birds like the loon and the peregrine falcon were so scarce that a lot of people thought their populations could never be brought back. But there was also a movement underway by then, which had started in the 60s, to bring back some of those species. There was an understanding that they're all connected and that nothing can survive without all of the parts of the ecosystem. So Steve joined the department just when there was starting to be a lot of effort and money devoted to those species, and he became the turtle guy. He hand-raised hundreds of turtles.
Well, his passion is this thing called the Non-Game and Nature Heritage Program. I don't think I'd ever heard of it until I read your story. So tell us more about what it is, how it formed, when, why.
Well, it formed to focus on those species. And one of Steve's jobs was to find volunteers who would help him in sort of protecting nesting turtles on the shores of Lake Champlain and help him do bird counts and help him assess how many species there were. And then it was the program would bring that information back to the Agency of Natural Resources so that decisions could be made about how to spend the money and, you know, how to protect these species. And, you know, part of his job was keeping a focus on this when, you know, he went through many, many administrations, and there was always sort of a tussle for money, as there is in any state program.
Right. Well, as you mentioned, he became the turtle guy. What was his special affinity for turtles?
Well, I think that he just felt that they needed a lot of help, and they weren't going to get it unless he went out there on the shores of Lake Champlain day and night to make sure that they were safe from predators. There were nesting turtles there. There was one particular spiny, soft shell kind of turtle that just was being raided by raccoons and skunks and foxes and things like that. And he built fences to keep those predators out. He shot the predators. He put wire mesh over the nests at strategic times just to keep those turtles safe. And other biologists in the department who I talked to said that he has been responsible for saving the life of thousands of those turtles and restoring those populations. He also worked with a different kind of turtle at his house in Moncton. He's been monitoring a population there since 1984. And many of those turtles, those turtle hatchlings whose nests had been disrupted, ended up in his living room.
Wow, that is dedication to the turtle. Now, his work and the work of the Non-Game and Natural Heritage Program, it seems like a no-brainer now. But as you said, you know, that wasn't always the case with different administrations. You have to get funded. You have to continue keeping that funding. So, you know, what was how did he convince the state that this was really a priority?
Well, he has a pretty open mind, or he seems to understand the perspective of people who say that attempts to protect wildlife make it more expensive to do business. And, you know, he says he gets it, that some people have to make a living off the land, and that might include destroying habitat. So his colleagues all say that this is one of the great things about Steve. Not only does he have this affinity for saving these animals, but he also knows how to he has this affinity for politicians and bureaucrats and his staff, where he can work with these humans and get them to understand what he's trying to do and sort of do it diplomatically enough to make it through administrations that have different levels of commitment to what he's trying to do. They said, his colleagues said, this was one of his great strengths, was wrangling the human beings that are involved in wildlife conservation.
Yeah, that is two completely different skill sets, unique in an individual like Steve Perrin. He also worked hard to find revenue sources, develop revenue sources for this program, right?
He did. That's something he's really well known for. He got the state to put a checkoff on our tax form so that we can actually donate as we're filing our taxes to his program. And he was also instrumental in getting the license plate, which has also sent a little bit of extra money to the program.
Every time I see that now on the tax form, I'm going to think of Steve Perrin. Think of it as the Steve Perrin box as I check it, because it's really great, you know, that he's come up with this. You know, the other thing is, you know, like I say, it's a no-brainer now, but the mindset has changed to be in alignment now with Steve's beliefs that all these species, you know, do have a place here in Vermont. What pushback did he receive, though, through the years to kind of make sure that the non-game species were protected and there was this program to make them a priority?
Well, I think even nationally and in Vermont, there was a tremendous amount of pushback when these the first environmental protection laws were enacted, and developers suddenly found out that they couldn't just do what they had been doing, which was, you know, take a piece of property and just shape it however they wanted. And it suddenly started costing a lot of money for permitting and protecting, and in some places, projects were halted. And, you know, all of the environmental protection people in Vermont that kind of pushback still exists from developers who are trying to get projects done. You know, we still have that huge push and pull over Act 250, with some people saying that it's hindering the development of housing, which the state really needs, and others saying that it's vital to keeping the state intact and keeping it healthy as we go forward.
Were hunters also worried that this protection of non-game species would take away from protection of the game species?
Yes, because Fish and Wildlife does have a huge role to play in keeping those populations healthy so that people can hunt them. And so they were worried that money flowing to a different population of animals would take away from the protection efforts for the game species.
But that hasn't necessarily played out that way, correct?
I think what you mentioned earlier about how there's a greater understanding, that has become a huge part of the hunting community, where they are trying very hard to educate their members and the public about this balance, and trying to show themselves as being part of this balance, and also recognizing that conservation is actually a part of the mission of hunting groups, not only of the species that they're hunting, but of other species in the state, just to keep, you know, the hunted animals healthy and keep their habitat the way it should be.
I want to get back to the turtles. This work at times included his own family.
Yes, I talked to his daughter, Molly, who is now a turtle biologist. She's working in Massachusetts, or she's working for a group in Massachusetts, although she travels around protecting turtles. And she said she remembers a time when there was actually a turtle seizure. Some turtles had been illegally imported, and they were all housed in the Perrin living room while state officials tried to decide what to do with them. And Molly said she remembers she was young enough to name all the turtles, and she created a spreadsheet of all of their names. And she said that turned out to be good practice for being a biologist, where lots of spreadsheets are involved.
That is probably my favorite part of the story. It's a very warm story about the work of Steve Perrin and the steps he's taken to protect these non-game species, particularly the turtles. Now that he's retiring, Anne, is there someone stepping up to make sure that this work continues?
One of the things that Steve made sure to do was to keep his collection of volunteers very, very strongly invested, so that he's going to have this strong volunteer force when he leaves. And now there are biologists who are already working on the work that Steve has done, and they assured me that this work is going to continue. They're just going to miss Steve's deft handling of the humans in the department, the humans in the greater bureaucracy, and the wildlife volunteering efforts.
You spoke with Steve. Yeah, you spoke with Steve. What kind of person did you encounter?
He's pretty friendly and calm, with a sense of humor about the fact that he will be forever associated with the living room turtles. And he, after all this time, although he's still monitoring his wood turtles in his own backyard, he's looking forward to doing something else. Funny thing about Steve is that he doesn't have a mobile phone. And they don't have a landline, so he doesn't have a phone. And now his the work of his wife is convincing him to get his own phone.
Oh, my gosh, I love it. And how much will he continue to protect the Vermont's non-game species and, of course, the turtles?
Well, he's gonna keep protecting that population that he's known since 1984 of wood turtles in Moncton. But he's for someone who has devoted his life to this for so many decades, he's definitely ready to not do the state turtle mission anymore. He's thinking about traveling and just having a somewhat more relaxed life, where he's not responsible for thousands and thousands of species.
No kidding, because I got the feeling from your story that, he's decided to retire. It's his decision, but he just doesn't seem like the guy who could just, take a break, but it's nice that he has found that there's a work-life balance after all this.
I was surprised too. I didn't expect him to tell me that, no, I'm ready to just, hang out and do not very much for a while now and, just enjoy Vermont.
And this has got to be fun. You're normally on the business beat. I know you also do, breaking news stories, but this is kind of a nice break from some of the business stories that you get to do.
Yeah, Bob Pop, who is Steve's colleague and I'm friends with Bob and his wife Beth, he wrote to me during the legislative session and said, you have to write about Steve's retirement. You cannot imagine the impact he's had on the state. There needs to be a story. And I was too busy during the session. And then Bob wrote to me a few more times, and I just, when the session was over, I started looking into it, and I'm so glad I did, because I have learned a lot.
Yeah, well done. You can read Anne Wallace Allen's story in this week's 7 Days or online at 7daysvt.com. Anne, thanks so much for being with us again this morning.
Thank you so much, Rick. I enjoyed it.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break, and then we'll be back to hear what events Burlington has planned for tomorrow's Juneteenth celebration. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. Out with friends the other night, And I mentioned that I was going to be talking about Burlington's Juneteenth celebration on the show this morning. Several people weren't sure what Juneteenth is. I know they're not alone, but it is time to learn what it's all about and why what happened in Galveston, Texas over 150 years ago is part of this nation's history. We're going to discuss Juneteenth and how Burlington is stepping up and celebrating it tomorrow. Here to help us is Taisha Green, Burlington's Director of Racial Equity, Inclusion, and Belonging. Taisha, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Listeners, if you've got a question for our guest, you can join us by calling 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. As I mentioned, people are starting to hear the term Juneteenth, but aren't really sure what it is. Do you mind starting us with a bit of history?
Oh, yes, for sure. So, as everyone knows, the Emancipation Proclamation was signed in 1863 by President Lincoln. And 2.5 years later, the final enslaved people in Texas, Galveston, Texas, were released from bondage, and that's only because a military personnel went down to inform them that they were free. For whatever reason, the slave owners at the time decided to keep their enslaved people working in that town. And I say working loosely, forcibly working in that town. And because most enslaved people could not read, they had no idea that they were free. The reason why we celebrate 1865, June 19th, 1865, and not the Emancipation Proclamation is because until all of us were free, none of us were free. And I think that there was a consensus and an understanding of that because there were people from 1700 to, 1863 who were Black and were free, born free, but there was still a lot of enslavement going on in the South and in some areas in the North, and so that made people understand that without papers that prove that you're free, in some cases, even if you have papers, you could still be enslaved, kidnapped, and be enslaved and working in enslaved in the South. So for us, because those final enslaved people were freed that day, that's the day that we consider Freedom Day. Mm-hmm. And that's the day that we consider all Black people being released from bondage in this country.
2.5 years after they should have been free, 2.5 years. I can't imagine the joy and the pain they must have felt when they received the news. Is much known about those individuals who were finally notified of their freedom in Galveston, Texas that day?
There's a little bit known about them, because they're the ones that started Juneteenth.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some books and articles written about those enslaved people who were finally released from bondage, but and the word of that spread throughout the South and throughout the country, and so all formerly enslaved people and free people started to celebrate June 19th. It started out as Jubilee Day,
yeah,
and then it switched to Juneteenth. It was named that so that they could put June and 19th together.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I'm so glad you brought that up, Taisha. It has been celebrated since 1866. So the first anniversary of Juneteenth was celebrated in Texas. It became a state holiday in Texas, I think, in 1979. Why has it taken the rest of the country so long to kind of catch up to this celebration?
I think that it's hard for the country to face what actually happened in this country. There's always an air of people wanting us to forget. They want us to forget that there was slavery in this country, and they want us to believe that it happened a long time ago.
Yeah.
And that we shouldn't talk about it, we shouldn't think about it, we shouldn't let it, interfere with our lives. But the truth of the matter is that slavery, the bondage ended in 1865 for all Black people. However, there were some things that happened since then during Reconstruction. The sharecropper job title had also kept those freed people enslaved and latched on to their former masters and their former master's family. My great-grandparents were one of those slaves, sharecroppers who, when my great-grandfather was born, he was born at the master's house in Mississippi, and they lived at the master's house for a long time. He started having children, and those children were born at his former master's, well, his parents' and grandparents' master's house.
Mm.
And when he became a sharecropper, he stayed indebted to that family until the 1980s. So you were still enslaved in this country after slavery, but in a very different way. And another thing to realize is that black people did not become full citizens of this country until 1968.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a long time ago. It's very recent memory.
Yeah. 156 years after June 19th, 1865, our country has finally declared it a national holiday. What are your thoughts about that?
I think it's great. I was excited to hear about it. I hope that this doesn't mean that we believe that as a country that we can stop talking about all the inequities for black people. We also, at the same time as the country is recognizing this day as they should, there are also several states who are trying to ban critical race theory so that this day will not be taught in their schools. So it's a little hypocritical in that sense, but I was so elated and so happy to see the president sign this into law, and I think it's very, very important for what our children and our children's children and generations after them will learn about this day and why this day is important.
Taisha had a caller earlier to the show and brought up critical race theory, didn't understand the definition of it. So help us out. What is critical race theory and why should it be taught in our schools?
It's a theory. it was started by Derek Bell, and there are three tenets to the theory. Now I feel like I'm back in grad school, so let me try.
That's
to
all right. We need this education.
Yeah. So the critical race theory, it basically talks about how there are certain rules that black people have to abide by, but there's a way to get around those rules and to think critically about white supremacy culture, societal and structural racism. Think critically about being liberated from that and use storytelling, elevating storytelling over evidence and reason and rejecting the concepts of what we have known so far to be truth. And that's because, you know, in all of our education, we are not taught about race in a meaningful way. We're not taught about what actually happened, the truth of what happened in this country. And one really good example of that was recently with the Tulsa Race Massacre.
Right.
That a lot of people found out about this year and at the 100th year anniversary of it.
Mm-hmm.
It was not taught. It wasn't even taught in Oklahoma. So, basically, you know, you're replacing kind of what people believe to be true with factual information from lived experiences of black people. And so critical race theory is just that. It's a theory. The only time people learn about critical race theory is in graduate school or law school. You don't really learn about critical race theory in K through 12. There's
right.
never been, because it's so complicated, there's never been anyone doing that in a regular classroom setting for K through 12. You have to get to the graduate school level to even know or hear anything about critical race theory.
I know I invited you on to talk about Burlington's Juneteenth celebration, and I hope you don't mind that I've asked you to really delve into the history of Juneteenth before we get into the celebration. Taisha, has Burlington had Juneteenth celebrations in the past?
The city has not. There has been other celebrations that have been done by community members and community groups. But as far as the city sponsoring a Juneteenth celebration, no, this is the first one.
So why has the city decided this year to have this day-long celebration?
I approached the mayor when I got here last year. I got here in March, but I started working in April. And I meet with the mayor on a weekly basis, one-on-one. And I pitched the idea to him, I believe, my first week of work here.
Give us an overview of what will be happening tomorrow in Burlington.
Oh, there is so much happening tomorrow. We have two traveling museums that will, one will be at the Flynn, the other one will be at the Flynn Elementary School, the other one will be at Roosevelt Park. And these traveling museums will bring artifacts from 1700s to present day. We have a theater company coming from New Jersey. Who will perform Frederick Douglass's What to Be Slave is Your Fourth of July.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually called Not My Fourth of July, and it's their rendition on that famous speech that Frederick Douglass gave. They will be performing three times throughout the day. We will kick off Juneteenth with a gospel brunch at City Hall Park with Lake Champlain Gospel Choir. That starts at 10 a.m. and it goes until noon. We will have a Black Artist Market on Main Street where you can come and purchase things from different entrepreneurs and artists. We will have a Black Healing Village at Champlain, and that Healing Village is for Black people to come and pay homage to their enslaved ancestors, light a candle for them. So there's going to be an altar. It's a very private, very secluded space for Black people to heal from the trauma of slavery in this country. I'm sorry. We will also have there's more than 40 events. We'll have a kid imagination zones at every single location. We have five locations. We have panels. There's a panel called Contextualizing Juneteenth, and it has five Black leaders, Blaine Mpense, Sudana Davis, Zariah Hightower, Tabitha Moore, and Kaya Morris. Mm. We have a farming panel at the library. There's some stuff going on at Echo. We have a lot going on. There's a poetry contest for the youth that I would encourage everyone to come out and support the youth, who will get up on stage and recite some poetry. We have three murals going up across the city, Juneteenth inspired murals, one at the skate park, one in the New North End, and the other at City Hall Park.
What I'll do right now, Taisha, is let me give the website where the full schedule is, and then we'll kind of get into some of this. JuneteenthBTV.org is where you'll go to get the full schedule. One thing you haven't mentioned is music. There's a lot of music going on. Tell us about some of that.
There's a lot of music. Oh, my gosh.
I mean, you mentioned the gospel brunch, but go from there.
Yeah, music all day. We're going to kick it off after the gospel brunch with Myra Flynn, who will be at City Hall Park. I know that there are, I'm new to the area, so A2VT is performing.
Oh, good.
I know that Dwight and Nicole are performing at 7 p.m., there's so many artists. Sin is performing at Roosevelt Park. DJ Milo Grant is performing at City Hall Park. DJ Louis Calloran is ending the night with a dance party at City Hall Park from 9 to 11 p.m. There's so many artists. It's hard to name them all, but just you can pick and choose. We have transportation that will take you from site to site.
Yeah, let's talk about that transportation. Where will people find that?
Yes. It will be at every single site. There will be big signs that tell you that there's a shuttle that stops there. It runs every 20 minutes at every site, and it will take you from site to site. And you can download the app from our website. There's a link on the schedule page of our website, and you can plan your day. So if you want to see an event at Roosevelt, and then the next event you want to see that's at Champlain, you can plan that route on the app and be ready to go to each site to see those events.
This reminds me of when Burlington would have first night, and you would do that. You could, you know, figure out where you want to be at 5 or 6 o'clock. This is going all day. And again, I'll give JuneteenthBTV.org. You can plan out your day. Probably a smart thing to do. You mentioned music, DJs, getting people to dance. You also have, I think, a great dance group performing.
We do. And I think the dance, Crystal Brown, is doing dance at Champlain. At Champlain School. I believe it's at 6 p.m.
All right. I want to talk about some other interesting performances. One is some Double Dutch going on.
I love Double Dutch.
I love this.
And we would do it in the street back home in Minneapolis. And so Double Dutch is a big part of the Black experience. So Double Dutch event will be really fun. So if you've never Double Dutch before, there'll be people that out there to show you how to do it. You'll have a good time.
Yeah.
And we also have 3-on-3 basketball.
Exactly.
At Roosevelt Park as well. Yeah.
When's that happening?
The 3-on-3 basketball, I believe, is happening at 3 p.m. at Roosevelt Park.
Oh, that's easy to remember. 3-on-3 at 3. Okay, now, the other thing that people will be really concerned about, because if you want to make a full day of it, you'll be eating, and you've got some great food lined up.
I do, and all the food is free.
Wow.
It's free until it runs out. So we got enough food to last us for a good while. It all depends on how big the crowds get, but all the food and the water are free for this event. So you will be able to eat to your heart's desire. We even have Hangry Donut bringing some donuts in. New Alpha Missionary Baptist Church, their first lady of the church is making sweet potato pie and banana pudding.
Oh.
So it's going to be amazing.
Oh, that is so great. I know Kismayo Kitchen will be there, Single Pebble. There'll be some wonderful food purveyors that you've fallen in love with, and you'll get to enjoy the food during this Juneteenth celebration. How about educational programs that are going on during the day tomorrow?
So much education. Like I said, there's some educational programs at the Echo, at the Fletcher Free Library. We will have a panel discussion, but we'll also have other speakers throughout the day that will provide some education on Juneteenth. We have a keynote speaker of sorts coming from New Jersey. Her name is Noble Jules. She will do a keynote speech about Juneteenth at 8:30 p.m. at City Hall Park. So throughout the day, we have several speaking opportunities for you to come and listen and learn about what Juneteenth is, why it's important, and how do we go from here, is what we're trying to do. This is about a celebration, so there won't be any, you know, sad songs or any sad speeches. This is about resiliency and how we have been resilient for all this time, and how do we keep moving forward.
Are tickets needed for any of the events being held tomorrow?
The only ticket that was needed was for the brunch, and that has been sold out within hours.
Wow.
And so, and it was free, so you just have to register for it, but they were gone pretty quickly. So that was the only ticket that you would need for this event. Everything else you can just walk up to at your leisure.
And that was to eat at the gospel brunch, but can you still attend and listen to the music from 10 to noon?
Yes, and we expect people to do just that from 10 to noon. Just come and find a spot on the grass and listen to the music. Everybody's welcome. So it's just for the sit-down part of the brunch where you need it. a ticket if you were going to be fed during the brunch.
Okay, outstanding. So you still can attend and hear that beautiful gospel music, which will be great. I do want to ask you a little bit about your position. You're the first director of racial equity, inclusion, and belonging in Burlington. So what are your goals in that position?
My main goal, and it's a lofty one, is to ensure that race is no longer a determining factor in any measurable outcome. And right now, race determines where you live, how you live, where you work, and how you work. Race determines if you will be successful or not successful. Race determines how educated you are. Race determines how long you will live. So I want race to not be a determining factor in any outcome. So we're going to really focus on the social determinants of health, things that make us healthy, you know, like having a safe place to live, having, you know, clean water and good food, vegetables, fresh and healthy foods. Being healthy, you know, going to the doctor is probably 10% of that. But the other 90% is all about environment and how you live your day-to-day life. And so we're really focused on improving those social determinants of health for Black and brown people across the city.
And what does it mean to you to be the first person to hold this position in Burlington?
It's exciting. I guess I haven't really thought about it. I'm more of a background player. I like to be a collaborator and just have everyone on my team be the leader. I know that I'm officially the leader of the team, but we have some spectacular people on my team, and they're just as qualified to lead as I am. And so I play more of a collaborative role on my team, and all of our ideas, I just use those ideas from all of us to elevate them as much as I can.
Well, welcome to Vermont. Taisha Green is Burlington's first Director of Racial Equity, Inclusion, and Belonging. Listeners, to learn more about the city's Juneteenth celebration, again, the website is JuneteenthBTV.org. Taisha, congratulations on being named to this position. Thanks so much for being on our program today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye. And that is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Zoe Helena, Rachel Connor, and Willow Zartarian. And today, directed by Lee Cattell. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Please feel free to suggest topics or guests. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here on Monday.